Good evening. For those of you whom I haven't had the pleasure of meeting, my name is Paul LeClaire, and it's my privilege to be the president of what I think is the greatest library in the world, the New York Public Library. And I'm delighted to welcome you all here this evening to the trustees' room of the library, to what is going to be a remarkable program, without any question whatsoever. We're here because the library has accumulated over the past decades one of the single greatest collections of its kind in the world, documenting various aspects of the LGBT community. When you take all the various documents that we have and you put them side by side and you lay them out, I'm told by our librarians that those documents extend to 7 miles of boxes. Now, that is the biggest archive of any in the library. I used to think that an archive that, you know, went from here to 34th Street was a big archive. But if you imagine 7 miles, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of linear feet that is, of archives of all kinds, institutional, organizational archives, the ACT UP archives, the GMHC archives, as well as enormous amounts of personal memorabilia, of what we call ephemera, that are posters and handles and so on and so forth, that starts to give you a sense of the single immensity of the collections that relate to LGBT communities. And it also, I hope, gives you a sense of how terribly important the preservation and the processing of those archives are to people today and to people in the future who will be writing and rewriting and interpreting and reinterpreting the social history and the personal history of individuals in these communities. Jason Bauman, who is here before me, who is one of the wonderful librarians here at the New York Public Library, and who is the key librarian on our staff in terms of supporting the LGBT community, has done an exhibit for you outside of not even the tip of the iceberg, because I'm not sure how small the tip would be of an iceberg that's got 7 miles underneath it. But it does, it's an example of how varied the collections are. The first document in these collections goes back to 1500, and it gives you a sense of how important they are. Our mission, with your help and the help of others who aren't here, is to process that entire collection, because until it's processed, nobody's going to know what we have. It will not be accessible, because you won't be able to find out what's in all of these different kinds of boxes. And our second objective is to put very, very substantial amounts of it online. We already, through Jason's really brilliant efforts and those of his colleagues, we've already put 3,000 items of the collections online. But there's an immense amount left to go, an immense amount left to be processed. That's going to take money. And the leadership of this group has been brilliant in its fundraising to date, but we're going to have to raise a whole lot more money. And what most people don't realize is that this is a private library under private control, and most of our work is sponsored and supported by the private sector. I always kind of think that the New York Public Library is misnamed. It should say on the outside of the building, the New York Private Library, open to the public without charge as a consequence of private philanthropy. The city, it's true. The city gives us only 22% of our operating support. So if you thought of us as a city agency, it's understandable why you might have thought that, but we're not. This is not like the Boston Public Library, the Chicago Public Library, the San Francisco Public Library. This is a private nonprofit corporation that runs the greatest library in the world completely for free, and does so in the 4 research libraries primarily as a result of private sector support. So men and women like yourselves and many thousands of others who are as enlightened as you are and see the value of a great library like this for the welfare of New York. There's one thing on your seats that I'd like to draw your attention to, and this is a reprint, not so elegantly done, unfortunately, of an editorial that was in the Daily News a week ago yesterday. And this shows you just the kinds of things that this great library does, because many years ago, when a young person nobody had ever heard of named Barack Obama came to the New York Public Library for help in trying to find a job, our librarians helped place him in his first community organizing job in Chicago. And what you have here is not stuff that we made up, but things that he's on the record as having written and said himself about the value of the New York Public Library and the Mid-Manhattan Library across the street to him. Now, every month we have 1.25 million visits to our libraries in the whole system. That's a system of 91 facilities. There have to be lots of young potential Barack Obamas among those people. So what we do is really the Lord's work. We give everybody access completely for free, with no questions asked, to all kinds of incredibly important information, and that's done by our wonderful staff. So if you're interested in this place for any variety of reasons, you couldn't have chosen a better organization to be supporting, because everything that we raise is not for ourselves. It's simply to be turned over for the benefit of the people of New York, and now increasingly through the web around the world. The program tonight is going to be a wonderful one. I don't have the privilege of introducing the speakers themselves, although I've just spent time with them, and they are two extraordinary human beings, as I think you all know. The privilege of introducing them goes to two great people in our life here at the library, and that is Carrie Maloney and Hermes Malaya, who are the founders of the LGBT support group. They've been with us at the library for many, many years, about at least 20 years, as active volunteers, bringing all kinds of wisdom and support to us, organizing all kinds of different groups, starting with the Young Friends group many years ago. They grew up, and now they're turning their attention to things other than that, and their principal focus now is helping us find the resources that we need to bring these extraordinary collections to ever wider audiences and to process them all. They are some of the best friends one could possibly have, either as an individual or from an organizational point of view. And it's my great pleasure to introduce both of you simultaneously. You, just one, just Hermes. So this is a hero. Give him a great hand.
Thank you. Welcome, Irva Shee, Bishop Robinson, ambassadors, and friends of the library's LGBT collections. Before introducing our speakers, I'm going to give you a brief report describing the accomplishments of our inaugural year at the LGBT Committee. As many of you know, the library has been collecting LGBT material since the institution was founded, holdings that affirm our community's contribution and document our struggles. Our committee was created to expand awareness of these collections and to broadcast the library's commitment to serving the LGBT community. Sorry. Our group is dedicated to raising funds so the entire collection can be accessed online anytime, as Paul said. And so far, corporate and member support, as well as bequests, have exceeded $1.5 million. And this includes a very significant support of our straight allies. This year, we digitized, as Paul said, about 3,000 images, and we serve them online in the library's LGBT digital gallery. We're busy processing, as Paul said, collections of key LGBT activists and organizations, including the GMHC archives and the papers of K. Tobin Lehusen. Our dynamic website, LGBT at NYPL, connects users with the committee and it shares the expertise of our collections manager. Our site advertises exhibitions and programs like tonight's conversation or the recent Derek Jarman film series. We provide access to health information via the library's HIV/AIDS collections, but also through links to other sources. LGBT seniors use our website for information on housing, social networking, and healthcare, and our young adult outreach includes events like the anti-prom, which we hosted in the spring, where Simon Doonan crowned the king and queen of the prom in Astor Hall. Our members have connected us to significant collections of LGBT art, periodicals, and archives. These are exciting materials whose donation we're currently negotiating, and we're committed to an even more ambitious agenda for 2009, with exhibitions and programs commemorating the Stonewall and a follow-up to the library's groundbreaking Becoming Visible exhibition, which really broke records here. In the spring, we'll also be hosting our first visiting scholars who are recipients of a new travel fellowship that was funded by Martin Duberman for people using our collections. Tonight, we welcome members of prestigious corporate diversity groups because it's essential that our committee continue to reach out to new audiences like yourselves. In closing, I'd like to leave you with a request, and that is that you please make sure that your name is on our mailing list so that we can keep you informed about programming, and that you please join in the work of the LGBT committee by supporting the library at any level that you choose. You can do that at the membership desk, and you can also do it online through our website. With your support, we'll keep connecting the LGBT community with the New York Public Library, which is a unique resource for us and a very important symbol of our visibility. And now I'm going to turn it over to Carrie Maloney, who is my co-chairman and will introduce tonight's speakers. Thank you.
Well, once again, we want to thank you for coming. Dan Oshiak from Time Warner inspired and helped us pull together the idea of a corporate mixer, and we appreciate that effort. We have many old supporters here tonight, and I hope we have many future supporters, and that's a not-too-subtle plug. But last summer when we were coordinating tonight's program with Bishop Robinson and Urvashi Vaid, we all knew that the timing following on the heels of the election would give us fodder for conversation. I'd hope for happier fodder, but what we got will certainly make for lively conversation. The program will be followed by questions fielded by our LGBT collection manager, Jason Bauman. And afterwards, also, please join us for a drink and check out the smattering of materials that Jason has pulled together from the enormous collections. And to channel your mothers, maybe this is an opportunity to thank both of our guests for their really brave and tireless efforts on behalf of LGBTs everywhere. Urvashi Vaid is a hugely respected leader in the LGBT movement. She's a past executive director of the Gay and Lesbian Task Force and has worked for the Ford Foundation and the ACLU. Since 2005, Urvashi has been the executive director of the Arcus Foundation, a foundation created in 2000 that has given over $128 million to support the LGBT programs and the Arcus Great Apes programs. In 2007, the Arcus Foundation added its Religion and Values program, and I quote their press release, with the goal of achieving long-term change in cultural attitudes and religious institutions that currently stigmatize same-gender sexual orientation and gender variance. Bishop Gene Robinson is the first out priest to be ordained a bishop in a major Christian denomination. I think everyone in this room appreciates the face that Gene Robinson has presented to the religious and to the secular worlds as we confront the issue of homosexuality and religious institutions. In 2008 was a busy year for him. He and his partner of 20 years, Mark Andrew, were joined in a civil union, and the bishop's biography, In the Eye of the Storm, Swept to the Center by God, was published. So, ladies and gentlemen, Urvashi Vaid and Bishop Gene Robinson.
Thank you very much, Carrie, and everybody associated with the New York Public Library. It's an honor to be here, and I know we both feel that way.
Absolutely.
So, and thank you all for coming. It's great to see you. Well, we thought we would talk about a number of things that we are passionate about. Religion, sex, sexuality, politics, sex, sexuality. And the intersection of religion and sexuality is obviously where we should start, I think. You and I come from different worlds. For me, the secular, grimy world of organizing and politics, and for you, the more refined world of religious practice and spiritual thinking, and yet we both find ourselves working in critical ways at the intersection of religion and sexuality. Why is it important for LGBT people to work within religious institutions and around them to change them?
I think this is really important. I don't think there has ever been a civil rights movement of any kind so linked to religion. Religion and scripture have been used to support prejudice and bigotry. Certainly, scripture was used to justify slavery for countless centuries. Scripture has been used to subjugate and denigrate women. But in those two movements, I think religion played a supporting role. And in our movement for full and equal civil rights for LGBT people, religion is right at the center of it. And I'm not sure that we're going to make the kind of progress at the speed that we would like, and and we've learned that in this last election, and that it will not be lasting until we get on board with the religion thing. And partly that's because these sacred texts, at least at first read, seem to be clear about God's condemnation of homosexuality. I would maintain that, indeed, first of all, they are not clear. Anyone who claims to have a plain and simple reading of Scripture is just, you know, blowing smoke somewhere. And indeed, I don't think those seven passages, you know, Phyllis Trible calls the passages that denigrate women texts of terror, and LGBT people have seven texts of terror in Scripture that are used against us. I don't think they speak to the issues that we are, or they don't provide answers to the questions we're asking today. And so I don't think that we can particularly do this without doing the religious work. Now the problem there is, it's my contention, and it's really my motivation for what I do, is we need that to come from religious people. That is to say, we need religious voices saying, the church got this wrong, the synagogue got this wrong, the mosque got this wrong, the Abrahamic faiths have had this wrong all along. And they've been wrong about other things before, and we've changed our minds, and we can change our minds about this one as well. I would maintain, as a person of faith, God didn't get it wrong, but clearly the church has.
Well, I think that that's a really important point, but I think that the people of faith need to be the principal voices organizing and speaking out on these matters. But I would also argue that those of us who are not directly involved, except perhaps as parishioners in faith communities, also have a responsibility. Because, and what brought me to this realization is that it's clear from being a lawyer and working on LGBT rights and the civil and legal equality of LGBT people, that work only takes you so far, right? Because it doesn't get to the moral opposition that we face. If you look at the trends in, I mean, if you look at the General Social Survey, which has historically asked a number of repeating questions about people's attitudes about LGBT rights and LGBT morality. The issues on rights are moving. The trend in people's opinion about, American public's opinion about rights is moving in the right direction. It's, you know, majorities are saying they oppose discrimination. Majorities support gay people mm-hmm. working in different professions, teachers, even clergy. The trend is in the direction of acceptance. But when the question has been asked repeatedly, do you think sexual relationships between same-sex people are always wrong, sometimes wrong, or, you know, never wrong. The majority still says it's always wrong. Mm-hmm. The moral opposition to LGBT equality leads us to have to fight for our moral equality. So I continue to make the case. But the problem is that I find that a lot of people have been so hurt and damaged. Mm-hmm. A lot of LGBT people have been so hurt and damaged by organized religion that it's very challenging to get people to organize around it. Do you feel that?
Right, yeah. I try to be a bridge between those two communities, but I must say that to ask LGBT people to go back to their church or synagogue or mosque is not unlike asking an abused spouse to go back to her husband.
Mm.
And so I've never been critical of anyone who's been either skeptical about communities of faith or frankly, gun-shy. On the other hand, I point out to LGBT people all the time, the church you left may not be the church that's there now. That is to say, a goodly number of us are moving in this direction. Certainly, certain denominations are moving in this direction. And there are many, many safe places. And the fact of the matter is, I would argue that LGBT people have spiritual needs as well as anybody else. And I also think it's probably easier to come out as gay to your straight friends than it is to come out as religious to your gay friends. Partly because of what you just described about the kind of treatment we've had.
Mm.
And I think, not to toot the Episcopal Church's horn too much here, but I actually, well, when I was being considered, the consent to my election was being considered, the Bishop of Wyoming said it was not since the civil rights movement of the 1960s had he seen the church risk its life for something. Mm. And I actually think you're seeing the Episcopal Church risk its life for our community.
Let's talk about it. It's
dramatic.
Yes.
And you read about it in the papers with dioceses and parishes leaving and so on and so forth. And I think we're going to come out on the end of that because, you know, I agree that the arc of history bends towards justice. And in the end, God wins, right? In the meantime, it can be pretty painful. And so that's where we find ourselves.
But what is the status I mean, I'm glad to hear you be optimistic about the Episcopal mm-hmm. Church because it is a little demoralizing to read about all these dioceses splintering off over this issue. Now, I've always wondered, as somebody outside of the process a little bit, is it really this issue or are there other kind of more political issues of money, power? You know, sometimes the gay issue is used as a pretext.
Absolutely. I'll say actually yes to both sides. Yes, it's about money. Yes, it's about power. Yes, the gay issue is being used as a pretext. This is a split, I think, that was on its way. It's not unlike, you know, in my own mind, my own personal opinion, George Bush had it in his mind to attack Iraq. Mm. And 9/11 just gave him a great excuse. So I think this was a split on its way. And my election and consecration was a great reason to further it along. But the other thing I would say is, you say you read about all these dioceses leaving. That's four dioceses out of 117.
Hmm.
We're talking about, depending on how you count, maybe 1% or 2% of Episcopalians. So if you just read the headlines and you just listen to those who are speaking very, very loudly, you would think this is, you know, this is all going to hell in a handbasket. And in fact, the vast majority of the Episcopal Church is intact and getting on with the gospel.
Hmm.
But we mean to be an inclusive church. And I think at our general convention next summer, you will see us, I'm hoping, say to the worldwide Anglican Communion who is having difficulty with what we're doing, you know what? We understand that your context is different, and you don't understand why we're doing what we're doing, but we mean to be the church that God wants us to be. And if that makes you angry, if we get thrown out of the Anglican Communion, then so be it.
Indeed, we are all God's children, if
exactly.
one believes that. And
exactly.
There can be no exception. Well, let's turn our attention a little bit to California and the elections, just because they were alluded to earlier, and we thought we would talk about it. We're gathering on the verge of several historic moments, the historic new presidency, which has so many of us excited about the possibility of this country, and yet the losses that had so many LGBT people and our friends and families really upset and mobilized. How do you make sense of the California marriage loss, and what ideas do you have for the work ahead for the LGBT movement?
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating, isn't it, that that a state initiative like this has become such a national initiative. I don't think we've ever taken a vote like that to heart in a national sort of way before, and I think that's very exciting. I think part of that is because sort of as California goes, so goes the rest of the nation eventually. Mm. It's that kind of a bellwether state. And there was a lot of talk in the first week about the racial split.
Yeah.
And I think we need to stop that right now because it was not a racial split. I believe it was a religious split.
It was.
And
in fact, it was amusing to me that people were focusing on the African-American vote,
right.
which was far less than, I think,
6 or 7%
of the entire electorate in
right.
California, whereas the white vote is, what, you know, more than 50-something percent?
Right.
And the Episcopal, I mean, the vote of religious people was overwhelmingly against.
Yep, absolutely. And then you've got the Mormon Church pumping in 20-plus million. So I think the press really got that wrong and they ran with it. And I think we need to stand up about that because, you know, one of the great techniques of any oppressor is to get the oppressed to fight with each other, right? God forbid they should actually work together and fight against the oppressor. So they get the black community and the women's community and the LGBT community to start arguing over whose pain is worse, you know, who caused this failure, and so on. And I think we absolutely do that at our own peril.
I mean, that said, I do think that there are, you know, lessons to be learned about the lack of relationship between the African-American communities and LGBT communities.
Right.
Even though there are large numbers of LGBT African-Americans and people of color, there's the National LGBT African-American Organization, the National Black Justice Coalition, there's the Black Pride Societies, there's lots of activity, and yet many of the mainstream LGBT organizations don't really have relationships or positions around racial justice. We haven't shown up around issues of racial justice, and yet we expect communities of color to stand with us without that kind of reciprocity. And I think that the other issue that I think we have to examine that's an internal one for us is the closet. Mm-hmm. There is still a huge gay closet, and that's true in communities of color and in the general community.
Right.
And I think those issues are probably as salient as what you're describing, the religious differences.
Well, and I also think in terms of connecting the dots around all the isms, we need to take very much more seriously the ways in which those various oppressions are connected, and we do need to show up. You know, it is incredibly painful to me when I hear a gay man be sexist or, you know, a lesbian be racist or whatever. I'm thinking, what? Have you learned nothing from this experience? And yet it's there. And I think we need to really call that in our own community. And then we need to work. We need to work. I mean, racism is not a thing of the past. Sexism is not a thing of the past.
And homophobia is not a thing of the past.
And homophobia is certainly not a thing of the past.
Indeed. Well, it's so exciting, the mobilization after this defeat.
Yeah, you know, and seeing kids out really is amazing. You and I talked about this a little bit. You know, one of the real sort of bright lights maybe out of this defeat in California is that I think we've got a generation of younger gay and lesbian people who have never known anything but sort of unrelenting movement forward. And there's never been an enormous setback. And that's great. Except we know how long we've been fighting this battle. One of the most disturbing pieces I've heard in a long time on NPR, it was maybe about a week ago, they were doing a piece on the new movie Milk, which I think is premiering in New York here tonight. And they talked to enormous numbers of young LGBT people who had no idea who Harvey Milk was. And those who knew who Harvey Milk was thought he and his story were completely irrelevant to their lives. Now, that's crazy. It also points to why this collection here at the library is so important, because if we don't know our own history and we don't know our own heroes and heroines, you know, it's just... we just must do that. And so maybe this will energize the young LGBT community to understand that this is not a foregone conclusion.
Yeah.
And we're in the streets because we need to be. And we cannot give up on this. And, you know, I've looked to the African-American community so much to just kind of understand how all this works. And, you know, the thing about African Americans in the 60s was they went into the streets knowing that there would be dogs and fire hoses and death for some of them, and they went anyway, and they expected to pay a price, and but they got that it doesn't matter what part you play as long as you're in that in that march.
One of the things I find really exciting about this moment is that I came out and started organizing in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And so for at that time, the organized gay movement was not as institutionalized or staffed.
And not very
or
organized.
Funded. Not particularly. It was organized, but it was very grassroots, and it was very volunteer-driven. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, the idea of having a job in the LGBT liberation movement was absurd. And you didn't do it for the job or the career. You did it because there was injustice and you were organizing. Yeah. And so we would just, how did I learn to organize? I just sort of, we got together with people and said, this is outrageous. Let's pick up that movie. That's offensive. Let's get the police department on track. They're beating us up, and on and on. Mm-hmm. This Saturday, I went to the demonstration in New York, and it was thousands of people down at City Hall, part of the national mobilization that happened. And I wanted to know who the people were who organized it, because I'd heard that they were folks who'd done it for the first time in the internet. I went back to the staging area, and I just found the organizers, and I said, thank you, thank you. And all of them, there were five of them, and they said, we've never done anything like this before. We just decided we had to do something. And they pulled it together, and thousands of people came. And I thought, you know what? That's fantastic. This is the moment that many of us have been looking forward to, which is that there is a whole new wave of leadership that is out there, that has always been there. This moment came in the 80s around the mobilization around AIDS.
Right.
It came in the 90s around the mobilization around hate violence when Matthew Shepard was murdered. It happens in our movement when there are real affronts to ordinary people's sense of justice.
And it's nice that the motivating event was just a vote, that nobody died
True.
Over it.
And also what's nice is that there are so many straight allies out on the streets.
And I'm seeing this, speaking of young people, in high schools and colleges, the number of gay allies in gay straight alliances and so on are just incredible.
Right.
And it's a source of great pride, interestingly
Indeed.
Enough.
Indeed.
Isn't that our word, pride? amongst those
Isn't
gay
that
allies.
A sin?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
See, as a Hindu, I even know that. But I think that my favorite sign this weekend was there was a husband and wife, they were in their 30s, and he was holding a sign that said, every woman deserves a wife as wonderful as mine. And she had a sign that said, every man deserves a husband as wonderful as mine.
Great.
I just thought, they made me cry. I just thought that was so sweet, you know. And that was lovely. So, gee, I'm getting choked up right now. I know we wanted to open it up to people's questions, but I wanted to, I did want to ask you on a more personal level. We talked about this, and the question that you said you get asked all the time about being on the front line as a leader and taking the heat. And I get asked that too a fair amount, because not everybody sees themselves as, an activist, and then when you get thrust into these positions, it can be painful, and you do take a lot of heat. How do you address that? What is the joy that you feel in this leadership, in this role that you've taken on, despite the amazingly bitter and harsh things that get said in the middle of these debates in the church, for example?
Yeah, Yeah, because it is a personal question, I'll probably come at it from the faith side, because that's just who I am. I have to say that the way I've survived this last 5 years for me is that God has seemed so palpably close that a prayer almost seems redundant. Mm-hmm. God seems so close. And, right before my consecration, in the hour before my consecration, my partner Mark and I were strapping on our bulletproof vests and under my vestments and all of that. And our daughters were, quite worried, of course. And, I was able to say to her, one of the rewards of faith for me is knowing that death isn't the worst thing. Like, not living your life, that's the worst thing. And I think religion has so worried about the afterlife, the life after death, you know, my sense is God's going to take care of that. God's loving. God's going to continue to be loving. I don't care. I don't need to know the details. But what I am worried about is life before death.
Mm.
And I think if religious people worried more about life before death rather than life after death, we'd be a lot better off. So, and what my understanding of Jesus is that he was constantly saying, if you do the right thing, if you follow in God's ways, you're going to pay a price for it. And you're going to find a joy that you have never imagined.
Mm.
And I guess I would just attest to that being true.
Mm-hmm.
The other way that I can try not to absorb all the hatred and stuff coming my way is that I know how this is going to end. And, I mean, don't we know how this is going to end? This is going to end with the full inclusion of all of God's people in God's church and synagogue and mosque, and that's where we're headed. All we're arguing over is timing.
Hmm.
Now, it's important because every minute we waste is someone denied their rights or killed in a hate crime or whatever. But I don't think we have to get discouraged or burnt out because we know where this is going. And, you know, the Civil Rights Museum in National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, and it's at the old Lorraine Hotel where Martin Luther King was shot. And right at the entrance to it is this enormous black monolith. I guess it's granite or something. And going around it in bas relief is an ever upwardly spiraling procession of African Americans. And every single one of them is standing on somebody else's shoulders. So, you know, whether you're the first guy in the line or the last woman in the line, it's get in the line. Just get in the line. There's something for you to do, something little, something big. You'll take unmitigated grief for it. So what? So what?
Very well said. I couldn't agree more. So why don't we close out our piece of the conversation and open it up to a conversation with the room. Jason, are you going to moderate or do you want me to do it? Okay, no worries, I can do it. There's mics on either side, and just raise your hand if you want to offer a question. Yeah, right here. Holler it out if you want. Hi.
Hi.
My name's Karen. I have some friends who are part of a church called Revolution, which is led by Jay Baker. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. Jay Baker's the son of Jim and Tammy Faye Baker.
Oh.
He's pierced and tattooed, and Revolution is a gay-affirming church. It's quite small, and they have a following on the internet and stuff. And
so does Tammy Faye.
Yeah. And they have a hard time getting funding and stuff, and I just would be curious what advice you might have for an organization like this that's small and growing, is doing the right thing by trying to be gay-affirming and to, like, spread that message among religious people, because that's what my friend said, why my friend is so inspired by it, is that he would rather affect change from inside the church than outside. And so I'm just curious what advice you might have for an organization like that.
I don't know anything about that particular church. It's fascinating that that he came out of that very conservative family and is doing that. I would love to know his story. I just think it's important for religious people wherever they are to make those connections for people. I mean, the reason we are where we are, I think, in this country in this moment is, you know, the way change happens, it seems to me, is you have a worldview that pretty much explains the world to you, and then you have an experience for which this worldview is not sufficient to explain it. And so then you go into some kind of chaos. And you either wind up rejecting that experience, or you come out on the other side with a revised worldview that now takes into this in this new experience. And the reason we are where we are, I think, is that so many of us have come out. And the things that people were willing to say about us as a group 20 years ago, many, many, many people are not willing to say anymore because now they have a coworker, a family member, a next door neighbor, a former classmate, who is LGBT. And they're not willing to say those things about Sally or Sam, you know? And so I think it's really important for LGBT people who are connected to communities of faith to stand tall and be who they are and proclaim God's love for them.
And, you know, I would, to your specific question about the funding of faith-based work, it's absolutely true. There is so little of it. And the bulk of it is coming out of ordinary people's pockets in the congregation, volunteers. But that's true for a lot of congregations, indeed. They're funded by the people who attend. But then the denominations provide support as well. And with the new welcoming churches, there's not necessarily that relationship. So part of the challenge is to get traditional philanthropy, which barely gives to LGBT causes to begin with, and traditional philanthropy that focuses on religion doesn't
even,
so, right? even less so. I'm, you know, thinking of the Lilly Endowment or the Pew Charitable Trusts or the big names that one might associate with religion and human rights or religious thinking, the Templeton Foundation, which does a lot. I know that they're not yet, but we're going to work on that, on the philanthropic side. But I think maybe the ultimate answer is to take a little bit of a lesson from the grassroots organizing and fundraising done by the Obama campaign, in the sense that a lot of people gave little amounts of money, and together it made a lot of money, you know. And so maybe churches need to be much more the Facebook kind of fundraising and the web-based fundraising and, you know, get away from thinking about just passing the plate. We were tempted to pass the plate here for the collection, but we know y'all are
I don't know
go
what
home.
To do with that plate.
He was really wanting to pass the plate here. Sure. Anybody else? Yeah, please.
The face of communities of faith in regard to LGBT issues seems to be mostly on the conservative side. So the face of all faith communities, but Christianity in particular, seems to be extremely negative. Can you comment on why it is when there are so many people of faith who think otherwise, we hear so little from them?
Yep.
Excellent.
Well, I think, like me, they have day jobs. You know? I think liberal-thinking Christians tend to be in places where they're pastoring a congregation or, in my case, being the bishop of a diocese and so on. I mean, all of this that I do is in addition to what is considered a full-time job. And the conservatives have just been brilliant in raising the funds to, I mean, James Dobson just does what he does. You know, he's not trying to run a little church and you know, have a stewardship campaign in the fall and do potluck dinners through the spring. You know, he's just doing his vile work day in, day out. Although I must say, I just read today online that they're laying off 202 people, and their budget is going from 168 million this year to 130 some million. It's still a lot of money
that's
doing the wrong thing.
That's one organization. Focus on the family.
But that's $30 million less. So I think that's part of it. I think that religious people tend to be hopelessly inept about the media and not willing to do the hard work to be good at it and afraid of being branded. I mean, I've got, you know, lots of people who say that I shouldn't be in the news so much. Okay. You can have that opinion. If things would change, I wouldn't have to be doing this. for me, the reason I do so much work with the LGBT community is that I think such harm has been done there by people who have hurt them saying it's on God's behalf, that I want to do everything I can to say they got that wrong. And the God who has always loved you still does. And so if I get accused of being in the news too much or, you know, whatever, then, okay,
right.
I'll just live with that.
I think it's an excellent question, too. And I do agree with Bishop Robinson that a piece of it is that there is an organized anti-gay movement, conservative religious movement, in many faith traditions that is specifically funded and supported by institutions that we don't even know about. Mm-hmm. There's a little think tank called the Institute for Religion and Democracy, IRD, that has basically engineered and organized the fights within the Presbyterian faith.
Methodists. Episcopalians.
And Episcopalians. There's no countervailing think tank that I've been able to find for that, right. That's promoting an inclusive kind of theology and using the techniques and tools of organizing and training activists and having those activists stand up in religious, you know, councils. You have to understand religion as a series of institutions with a power structure. You have to do a power analysis of religion, not just a spiritual, you know, I mean, for me as an organizer, that's what you do. You do a power analysis. And how do you influence the hierarchy? And that's what our opponents have very thoughtfully done. The Catholic Church has its own fundamentalist group, you know, the Kate, what is that? The Catholic Opus Dei, thank you.
Yeah.
I knew you'd know. Knights of Columbus. I don't know about that.
Yeah. But you know, the conservatives have things that, like the Heritage Foundation and so those things didn't just happen. Some people got in a room and decided we'll create groups and give them wonderful sounding names, and we'll put money in, and we will hire some of the best thinking conservatives possible, and then they'll go
and
on CNN,
and
it'll say Joe Blow, the Heritage Foundation, and they'll look like they know what they're talking about. And that stuff doesn't just happen.
Right.
It's because people sit down and they organize it.
And
we've not seen that kind of thing, or the money. We need a couple of crackpot billionaires,
wait a minute.
Like the Institute for Religion and Democracy has, who are willing to just put in untold sums.
But I think we can underestimate the other issue that goes on for people of faith who speak up, which is persecution. You literally get called heretic. You get brought up on charges. You get, railroaded out of your church. I spoke once at the Convention of Presbyterians, and I met this guy who came up to me afterwards in his 60s, the father of a lesbian daughter, and he had committed the atrocious crime within the Presbyterian faith of, supporting his daughter's same-sex commitment in the church in Ohio that they were part of. Mm-hmm. And he was literally being brought up on charges of heresy. Mm-hmm. And I said, wow, this is the 90s, heresy, you know? And Presbyterians are very legalistic, I come to find out. I didn't know that. But there was a very formal process that he had to go through. It was like a court of law, but it wasn't a court of law. It was within the church. And he was preparing his case, and it was just preposterous to me that this man who stood up for his daughter was going to face this kind of challenge from inside the church that he had been a lifelong member of. So there is persecution. We see that, you know, explicitly in the Catholic Church. Why don't you see more of a witness publicly from supportive Catholics when you know that there is, you know, Catholics vote with their feet. They aren't following the doctrines of the church. But publicly, there's been a crackdown for anybody who deviates from orthodoxy. And I don't think that can be underestimated in terms of why there are not more progressive voices.
I say to my clergy, if you're not in trouble, I wonder if you're preaching the gospel.
You're such a liberation theologist.
Well, there you go.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sort of astounded by the amount of money and energy that's spent on this cause. You say the Dobson Foundation has only $100 million and all this energy is being spent on it. I'm also very moved by the, you know, Obama election. Do you think there's lessons? I mean, why is there so much energy being spent on fighting this issue? And are there lessons to be learned in understanding why this is being caused that may help to fix the problem?
I have a theory about why the resistance to our full rights is so intense. It's just my theory. I think this is really about the beginning of the end of patriarchy. And
let's hear it for
know,
that idea.
For a very, very long time, straight, white, Western, educated men have made most of the decisions for most of the world. And in the last 50 years, we've begun, at least, to bring people of color to the table. We've begun to bring women to the table. We've begun to bring the disabled to the table. And we've begun now to bring LGBT people to the table. And that gig is up. That toothpaste is not going to go back in the tube. And the world is never going to be the same. And given how long the world has been patriarchal, no wonder the resistance is great. So rather than be discouraged about it, I think we ought to actually take that resistance as a sign that we are really onto something. And that we are rethinking sexuality and gender and orientation and, you know, all of that. I mean, ultimately, I think we're headed with this, and I think this scares straight white men to death, but where I think we're headed with this is an understanding that there are as many sexualities as there are human beings. I mean, you get a whole room full of heterosexuals. Different things turn them on, different things turn them off. Some of them were abused, some of them are not, blah, 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 you know. The diversity is infinite. And we're going to run out of letters pretty soon. You know, we've got L and G and B and T and I and A and, you know, everywhere I go, there's a new one.
True.
And where I think we're headed is to say that whoever you are, that's good. That's good. And then all of a sudden, transgender people don't become so scary to us. Someone born feeling on the inside that they're different than what their genitals say on the outside, that's not frightening or abnormal. It's just intriguing, isn't it? And how does that feel for you, and so on? So in a world that for a very long time has been all neat and tidy and put into nice, neat little boxes, I think that way of going about life is terrifying. But I'm thoroughly excited about it. So I think that's why the resistance is so great. And not that I think dawn is about to come, but, you know, it's always darkest just before the dawn. And I do believe that at least we're at maybe the beginning of the end of patriarchy. And that will be a very good thing.
And I think you're so on to something when you say we should embrace it. Because I think a lot of times when I hear gay people in public discourse or when I hear the arguments of our movement, our opponents will say something like, well, you're an affront to traditional family values. And we'll say, no, we're not. We're just like you. And I want people to say, well, yes, we are an affront to traditional family values of domination, violence,
exactly.
Incest,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
rape. If yeah. you mean like the dysfunction that we see in families, mm-hmm. The notion that tradition is always good
right.
is something that personally as a woman and as a lesbian, I probably find deeply offensive. Mm-hmm. The traditions in my country of origin were to keep women very subjugated, to burn them when their husbands died.
Yeah.
That wasn't a good tradition. It was outlawed and, you know, mercifully the state declared that wrong, but people still took a long time, and people still believed in it, and maybe they still believe in it. So I don't know. I just think that we have to be willing to really do what is so unpopular, which is to say perhaps we are rethinking tradition and creating new traditions that are rooted in this whole other idea of human worth and justice and equality. Yes.
Yep.
In the 1850s, and the way it turned out was some denominations decided that they weren't going to ordain slaveholders and they weren't going to allow slaveholders to take communion, and everyone was okay with that. And then some denominations, like the Baptists and the Methodists, split, and mm-hmm. they're still split. Mm. And in fact, many of those same people who are heading up the Heritage Foundation and focus on the family are part of that Southern Baptist and Southern Methodist tradition. So what worries me, and I think you see this globally in the Anglican community, right, where some parts of the Anglican community are talking about secession in that very, very same way. That this, I mean, you know, as someone who studies the 19th century, you know, that this seems so resonant to me of there were people who were on board with anti-slavery sentiment within their churches, and those people who weren't on board were willing to put up with it. Mm-hmm. And then there were some people who said, no, you know, if I'm a slaveholder, you must allow me to come to church. You must allow me to be ordained, and felt strongly enough about it that they seceded and created their own denominations, and the Lutherans as well. Mm-hmm. You know, and you see within the Lutheran church right now these huge fights about ordaining openly queer people.
Or the Lutherans, you got the Missouri Synod and the
I know, ELCA. And as one of my closest friends is a Lutheran pastor who's a lesbian, and so, you know, it's living that right now. And so I'm wondering, while I would love to believe that, the dusk of patriarchy has come, I'm not holding my breath.
You and I won't see it.
Yeah, and particularly since, you know, my formative political moment as an out lesbian was Bowers versus Hardwick. That was the year I came out, was the year that decision came down. So to feel like, you know, it's very hard to resist that feeling of one step forward, two steps back.
Yeah.
But listen, you're absolutely right, and I'll give a secular answer, and then you can engage on the religious points that you're making. I think that's a really good point, but I still think you have, there's two things I would say. One, the Bowers decision, it took us from 86 to 2003 to get Lawrence. That's not really a long time, 17 years. And there were bleak 17 years. I didn't think that it would be possible for the Supreme Court under this political climate to do the right thing. And it did, you know. And then the other way I would encourage us to think about this is that, you know, that the splits that you described produced some progressive denominations and progressive new traditions. And so perhaps splitting is not a bad thing. You know, perhaps we should, as one of my artist friends says, embrace our extinction in some way, because if we believe in mutation and generation of something new, something positive might come out of it. Now, this is hopelessly optimistic, but that's not to deny that there are going to be a lot of painful setbacks and bad moments. But I think the reason one has a social change movement is that it's bigger than the individual. So in my lifetime, I will live through, and I have lived through, you know, living through the 80s and the AIDS epidemic of the 80s. There's still an AIDS epidemic of the current moment, let's not forget. But the AIDS epidemic of that moment was slightly different because of the bleakness of the possibilities for people living with HIV. And that, I thought, would never end. You know, and it still stays with me up here. But it did change. Even that changed. And then we lost so many. So I guess I feel with Jean that there has to be, with this religious splits that are happening, my question is, how can we support the people who are organizing? How can we strengthen the hand of a pro LGBT, of an inclusive faith-based movement? How can we support it and make sure that it has the tools and resources it needs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would just add to that about the splitting of the communities. You know, the Episcopal Church said a really interesting thing in the Civil War, which is that it continued to hold its general convention, and it had seats for the Southerners that were just empty. They went on and had their meetings. They called the roll. They called their names. None of them were there. And at the end of the war, they just came back and took their seats. It was a very interesting thing. The problem with communities that are in difficulty over these issues is, I think about this all the time, I don't know how to make them stay if they mean to leave. It's interesting that I'm not asking them to leave, but they feel they can't stay in a church that I'm in. And I'm not going to leave. But I don't know how to make them stay if they mean not to stay. Mm. And that is a real conundrum. What I think, what will be the general Episcopal Church stance on that, if something like a split occurs or we get thrown out of the Anglican Communion, is that we will continue to do mission and ministry with people in Africa and Asia, no matter what the hierarchs say. We will continue to work toward the Millennium Development Goals. We will continue to support women and children, buying anti-malarial nets, working in HIV/AIDS, and so on with those people. And maybe sometime late at night, over a beer, talk about homosexuality, but get back to malaria and AIDS and poverty the next day. So, and I think in the end, that's how we'll hold together as a communion. The Anglican Communion, unlike the Roman Catholic Church, was never meant to be a worldwide organization. As Desmond Tutu, when asked about, you know, what do Anglicans do, he said, "We meet." We meet. You know, from time to time, around various projects and so on, we get together. That's what we are. You know. So anyway.
Thank you, Bishop Robinson, and thank you, New York Public Library.
Thank you. Thank you.
I have the totally unenviable task of following you two, and which is what I was deeply, deeply worried about, and it's true that there's really no way I could follow up on your conversation. So I just wanted to thank you for your support in coming here, first of all, and really just that we are at this amazing juncture politically and socially, and to hear from the two of you of your thoughts on where we are was deeply, deeply inspiring and helpful to me. In the cases in the hallway, I've pulled some materials that give you just a sort of sense of the breadth and the depth of the library's collections, going from materials, Edward Carpenter's writings on homosexuality and his relationship with Walt Whitman, to the Fierce Pussy Collective and their Dyke, the Final Frontier posters, to give you really a sense of the range that we're talking about, hundreds of years of gay and lesbian history in the arts, activism, politics, in really every endeavor. I'd also want to remind you, I'm the coordinator of gay and lesbian collections here at the New York Public Library. I'm just one staff member among many who have done amazing things here over the years and for gay and lesbian collections, including Jack Martin, who is the coordinator of young adult services, who's really the leading person in the country for focusing on services to gay and lesbian teens. Melanie Yalas, who isn't here, who's really one of the great archivists in the field dealing with gay and lesbian collections. Two of the archivists are here who are working, or they were here on... who are working on GMHC's archives now and on Barbara Giddings and K. Tobin Lahusen's archives, thanks to the support of this committee, thanks to the support of Time Warner, and also the individual donations of everybody in the committee. So if you have any questions, please mingle. If you have any questions about the collections, please come and see us or about our services. And any questions about the committee, please talk to Karen Hermes or to Chanel Rivers or anybody else. So I hope I haven't left anything out. And thank you all for coming. This was amazing. Thank you.